Home Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. It's the last day before L.A. turns into Death Valley for Labor Day weekend, and the CDC tells states to get ready to distribute a coronavirus vaccine. If all that sparks questions for you like it does for us, we've got an expert with answers. Plus, understandable if you don't want to ride the subway these days, but what if the fare were to become the low, low price of free? It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us on this Thursday. Coming up, yeah, it ain't easy being a college freshman, no siree. But this year's freshman class, well, they've got a little harder than most.
So they're trying to both do that huge, you know, transition from being a high school student to a college student without, in many cases, actually having left home.
One college professor gives us the inside look at this strange new world we're living in. That's coming up in about 40 minutes. Stick around for that. But we start today in South Los Angeles, where questions are being raised about the tactics used by two LA County sheriff's deputies who fatally shot a black man there on Monday. The killing has sparked angry protests amid a national outrage over the police killings of other black men and women in the country. For a closer look at concerns over this shooting, we turn to KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, first off, remind us what we know about this incident.
Well, the sheriff's department says two of its deputies were on patrol in a section of South LA called Westmont, which sits just above the 105 freeway and is not part of the city of LA. That's why the sheriff's department patrols it. The department says the deputies saw 29-year-old Dejon Kizzy commit a traffic violation while riding a bike and tried to stop him. Kizzy dropped the bike and ran. Deputies chased him about a block, and video shows one deputy struggling to detain Kizzy. The department says at that point, Kizzy punched the deputy and a gun fell out of Kizzy's clothing. Kizzy is seen moving away from the deputy. By this time, the other deputy catches up to his partner and both open fire. The deputies say they opened fire because Kizzy, quote, made a motion toward the gun that had fallen to the ground.
Frank, what are the concerns about the deputy's tactics?
Well, the first concern is with the stop itself. The department has not said what part of the vehicle code Kizzy violated that prompted the stop. The Kizzy family attorney, Ben Crump, who also represents the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Jacob Blake, says Kizzy was profiled just like black drivers.
Dejon Kizzy is stopped for riding a bicycle while black, and he pays with his life.
But A, it's not unfathomable that this was a pretext stop. That's when police stop someone for a minor crime in order to investigate the person for what they suspect could be a more serious crime. So there are a lot of cops who would say this was a good stop, that deputies may have suspected Kizzy of a more serious crime, and that Kizzy ended up allegedly having a gun. But pretext stops are hugely controversial and have been condemned by the left and many on the right as often an infringement on people's rights. In fact, Jonathan Blanks over at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian institute, writes the Supreme Court's approval of pretext stops has provided virtual carte blanche for police to stop motorists and cyclists due to innumerable traffic laws.
Okay, so that's the stop itself. What are some of the other concerns about the deputy's tactics?
Yeah, so one question is what happened after a gun allegedly fell from Kizzy's clothing? The department says it was on the ground and the Kizzy made a motion toward it. It's unusual language. The sheriff's department and LAPD, for that matter, usually talk about a suspect reaching for a weapon. In any case, the gun was apparently not in Kizzy's hand when both deputies opened fire. That's prompted Black Lives Matter to say deputies shot and killed an unarmed man. A lot of cops would ask if they're supposed to wait for a suspect to grab the gun and point it at them before they open fire. Again, cops would call it a good shooting.
So, okay, what is the protocol then? And why don't police ever shoot just to stop someone from getting away? Like just in the leg maybe, as opposed to shooting a suspect in a way that could call for their death?
Sure. Once a deputy or officer decides someone could kill them or seriously cause them bodily injury, they are trained to shoot to kill. So there's a misperception that police can shoot someone in the leg or shoot them, shoot a gun out of somebody's hand. Your average police officer just isn't that good of shot. That's why they're trained to shoot in the middle of somebody's body, because that's the biggest target. You know, I should note, in the old days when police carried six-shot pistols, they were trained to fire two shots and then reassess the situation because they didn't want to empty their chambers. Yeah. But now, with 16-bullet semi-automatic Glocks, 16 bullets, you see police firing many more shots, and you occasionally see cases of contagious fire when one deputy shoots. Shooting prompts another deputy to open fire, and then both start shooting indiscriminately.
Contagious fire, is that something that police really use? I've seen that in the movies, Frank, but is that something real police use?
Yeah, you know, police leaders rarely say it rarely happens. Mm. You know, more progressive police leaders will say, yes, you know, it is something that occasionally happens.
Now, does the video shed light on how close Kazee might have been to the gun that fell to the ground?
No. This happens around 3 p.m. It's broad daylight, but there is a wall that obscures the security camera's view. But it does show the two deputies firing repeatedly at Kizzy, even after he is on the ground. Based on what you can hear in the video, they fire at least 15 and as many as 20 shots. You can see some of the bullets kicking up dust around Kizzy's body. Attorney Dale Gallipo also represents the Kizzee family. He argues the deputies violated numerous laws and department policies.
You have to de-escalate. You have to give warnings. You're supposed to show a reverence for human life. You're responsible to justify every shot.
And that last point is an important one. Once a deputy decides his or her life is in danger and they start shooting, they have to justify each shot. Again, a key question is whether Kizzee was a threat in the first place. Any presence of a gun places police on high alert, obviously, but it doesn't immediately allow them to shoot. Earlier this summer, it's worth noting, that a deputy shot an 18-year-old man a couple of miles from this very shooting location and shot him 5 times in the back. The deputy claimed Andres Guardado was going for a gun that had dropped to the ground next to him. So, you know, disturbing similarities with this case.
Yeah, appears so. Do we know if there is any police camp footage of this? And if not, why not?
Well, Sheriff's Department is the only large agency in the country without body cams. They've just delayed it for a long time. And we know this can be crucial evidence. The sheriff finally does start getting body cams next month. It'll take about 18 months to outfit each of about 5,000 patrol deputies.
One last thing, really quick, Frank. This comes in a year where California has changed laws regarding when police can actually use deadly force. Tell us about that for a minute.
Well, the standard has been changed to necessary. So a police officer can use deadly force when necessary, as opposed to reasonable. It's unclear how much practical effect that'll have. We'll have to see how it plays out in the courts.
That's KPCC reporter Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Public transit agencies in cities across the state have been hit pretty hard during this pandemic, with ridership levels dropping, leading to revenue losses and service cuts, and not to mention the risks the virus presents to employees. And LA Metro in particular is struggling. But yesterday, as a way to reimagine transit in the city, Metro officials announced it'll explore how to offer service for free. Ryan Fonseca has been following this. And Ryan, now we're, 6 months into the pandemic here in L.A. Can you give us a quick breakdown on how it's affected ridership levels and how that in turn has affected revenue?
You're right. Yeah. So it's been about 6 months with the local state home orders. When those went into effect back in late March and April, ridership really did plummet dramatically. At one point, the system had lost about 70% of its riders overall. So that obviously makes up one chunk of revenue for the system as far as passenger fares. But a much bigger financial hit is actually falling sales tax revenue. So that makes up roughly half of Metro's operating budget every year. And you might remember Measure M, you know, which brings in millions of dollars each year for the agency, billions actually, to expand and enhance bus and rail service. So with everyone staying at home, not going shopping, not going out to eat, and not frequenting other businesses, that, of course, really made all that funding just wither away. More recently, though, ridership has been ticking up a little bit. Right now, we're at about 50% of ridership compared to pre-pandemic levels. And Metro says it's running about 80% service levels at the moment. And, you know, more people are going out, more businesses are reopening. So people are trying to resume some semblance of normal life. And Metro's hopeful that as that happens, as we recover and reopen, that ridership will tick back up. But they say it could take up to 2 years to reach the level it was before March 2020.
Wow, 2 years. So how's Metro try to deal with that? I mean, what changes have been implemented to try and offset the losses?
Probably the biggest thing was they did cut bus and rail service, bus by nearly 30% and rail by about 14%. They basically did that through going to a modified Sunday schedule throughout the whole week. So fewer buses and trains running every day. They have increased some service, though, on some of the system's busier bus routes to try to offset that. But overall, according to kind of the latest figures, rail service is about 80% of what it was pre-pandemic, and ridership is about 50%. So they are trying to build that back up over time, kind of as we go, as the reopening process happens. In the meantime, Metro also got some federal help through the CARES Act. They got billions of dollars, just over $1 billion in federal funds back in June, July. But the agency and many other agencies across the U.S. say they'll need more. So they're seeking another round of relief to try to stay afloat as they get through the recovery process. And as far as cases on the Metro system, the agency is tracking that, and they do update it week to week. And so far, they've had nearly 350 confirmed cases among their employees and contractors. More than 90 of those cases have been bus operators who've tested positive. Two Metro employees and one contractor have died so far.
Now, just taking the long view here, what do these setbacks mean for Metro projects that were in the works, like, say, the Purple Line?
Right. The Purple Line will continue. There's a good number of projects that Metro is kind of putting in this thing they're calling the first bucket of priority projects. So that includes the Purple Line, which is now called the D Line. You know, they went through their name changes, so now they're all letter names. And other major expansions like the Crenshaw LAX line, the Regional Connector, and the Gold Line, aka now the L Line. So those big projects that were in the works under construction are still moving forward. But there was a whole other set of projects that were more in the development phase, and those have all been basically deferred 3 to 6 months, the Metro tells me. They hope to resume, you know, based again on how everything goes with recovery and funding and stimulus money. So one example of that would be the bus rapid transit projects that they've been developing in recent years. They plan to run a bus-only line similar to the Orange Line through the heart of the San Fernando Valley. So that was in development. Another line from Glendale to Pasadena was in the works. So those projects are basically deferred for now. But again, they hope to be able to readdress them in the coming months.
Now, yesterday you reported that Metro is taking a first step toward figuring out whether service could actually be free. Why?
Right. So that was kind of a big announcement last week at their regular board meeting. So Metro CEO Philip Washington announced that he is launching a exploratory task force, which will study how to turn Metro's whole system into a fare-free system. And they are going to move pretty fast. His goal is to have this launch at the start of 2021. As far as the why, he mentioned the pandemic and the impact it has on, you know, low-income LA County residents and people of color especially as one reason why it's more important now than ever and vital for people. So he kind of tied that to the impact of the pandemic, to striving for more equity and more financial parity for people moving forward. So that's sort of the big reasons that he cited last week.
So Ryan, a couple of things. I know all of this is very preliminary, but what's been said about what this process would entail? And then the big question, how is this going to get paid for?
Right. So it's still very preliminary. You know, they had their first meeting yesterday, so the details aren't very worked out. They have said, you know, they will approach this from an equity standpoint. They'll approach it to try to see how it might impact homelessness on the system, which has been a problem. As far as how to pay for it, that is, again, another thing they will look into. But it is important to note that passenger fares make up just a really small sliver of Metro's revenue each year. We're talking about 10% or less on average over the past decade. And more recently, it's hovered around 6 to 4%. That does still represent hundreds of millions of dollars, though. So they will be exploring federal and state funding, given how ambitious an idea this is. So they're hoping, you know, if it's approved, it would be the largest free transit system in the U.S. So there would definitely be a national interest in how it worked and what impact it could have on regional transportation.
I mean, Ryan, if it's free, I can't imagine that there won't be a lot of people that might take the train that maybe wouldn't take it before. Now, what's the next step here?
Right. So that, and that, what you just said is one incentive, right? They do want to try to build back their ridership. So offering free services is one way they see being able to do that more quickly than the current model. They just met starting yesterday, so they'll be working pretty fast if Washington gets his wish, because like I said, he presented the initiative to the board of directors and he said his goal is to have recommendations in place so they could go fare free at the start of the year. So, you know, the next several months will be pretty interesting to see how that develops and then they're able to actually move on that for 2021.
That's KPCC's Ryan Fonseca. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, this Labor Day weekend is going to be the kind of hot where people like to kid around with the line, how hot is it? Well, hot enough to kill people. So yeah, it's not going to be something to kid too much about. Also, have you been hearing that a coronavirus vaccine might be ready sometime before Election Day? Yeah, lots of stuff to wonder about, but we've got an expert with answers coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Labor Day weekend is upon us, and along with it, another heat wave. And amid that high heat, the state's power grid operator, CAISO, has issued a flex alert that will be in effect from 3 to 9 p.m. Saturday through Monday. Now, that's to help prevent possible power outages over this holiday weekend. And of course, this is happening in the midst of the pandemic, which will undoubtedly change how we celebrate the unofficial end of summer and handle the heat. Here to talk about how to stay safe in all of this is Dr. Robert Kim Farley, professor at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. And Doctor, first, let's start with the hard numbers here. How are we doing in terms of positivity rate, hospitalizations, and the number of cases in LA County?
It's a pleasure to join you again. So basically, I would call us, we are still in the first wave of COVID-19 here in Los Angeles. We had an initial plateau, then we opened things up a bit. We had a surge to a second plateau, and now we're beginning to see a downswing again. So we are approaching around 1,000 cases per day area, and positivity rates are also beginning to come down. So all of those are positive factors, but it means that we still need to keep the course to make sure that that downward trend continues, because we're still at around the 10 cases per 100,000 per day. We need to get below 7 before we can move to the next tier in the governor's opening plan.
And doctor, I can imagine that that sometimes could be a tricky message to put out there. Let me explain that. And that, okay, all these were great things, right? We're on a downswing. Things seem to be getting better, but you got to stay vigilant. You got to keep your foot on the gas. I mean, it's like you're trying to give some people something to be happy about, but then right away, you don't want them to lose control.
Exactly right. You've placed it correctly that, you know, there is a light at the end of this tunnel. It looks good. It's promising, the downward swing that we are on, but it only stays that way if we continue to follow the guidance, you know, masking, physical distancing, businesses following this as well. I think about there being three protagonists at this stage, all needing to play parts, you know, government and its health departments, businesses and schools, and the individuals. And so governments and the health departments need to be monitoring the situation, giving appropriate guidance, and then schools and businesses opening up appropriately and with the guidance and following those measures. And then the individuals, again, practicing the masking and physical distancing.
I guess the best way to look at it is if it looks okay now, imagine if we stay vigilant for two more weeks, for two more months, it'll look even better by then.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, as we approach, you know, lower levels below the 7 per 100,000 per day, we're going to be able then to start, you know, opening back up limited capacity restaurants and things like this. So, you know, these will all be kind of positive milestones along the way, but never at a time when we say, okay, abandon what we've been doing and go back to what it was beforehand.
Okay, doctor, now for that heat, I've seen that the beaches are going to be 90 degrees, downtown LA in the hundreds, and parts of the valley 113 possibly. So what are some key things to remember about staying safe from the heat?
Yes, I think the main thing to realize is you need to be recognizing you can have heat exhaustion, heat stroke. You know, heat is serious. It can kill. And so it's especially important that people have ways to be able to keep cool. The county will be opening up cooling centers for those who might need it, again, with proper physical distancing going on. And especially if you know someone that's elderly or something like that, that may be having more difficulties, to be able to keep in touch with them. We need to be looking out for each other at this time.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, staying indoors out of the sun, I would imagine, would be one of the top things on the list. But if someone is outside and wearing their mask, is there anything they need to kind of pay attention to? Because masks can be stifling sometimes in 110 degree heat.
The main thing to make sure that they continue to be drinking plenty of fluids on something like that. And maybe not the time to be heavy exercising out of doors at this stage.
Now, as of now, the beaches in LA and Orange County are remaining open this weekend. I think it's safe to assume that people will try to at least head to the shores if they can. Mm-hmm. But amid a pandemic, doctor, how safe are beaches and how can beachgoers be cautious?
Yeah, so I think the important thing, again, is to remember the basics of keeping the physical distancing, so don't congregate at the beach around people, and, you know, wearing of masks. So out in the ocean is fine, you know, again, staying away from each other. But again, this is a time to be able to enjoy the natural resources that we have available, take a hike, et cetera, but just be practicing, again, the physical distancing that will keep us all safe.
Is there a worse pocket of time during the afternoon to head out to the beach? Something like maybe 11, between 11 and 1 possibly, or is it just all day long?
Well, I think you're alluding to the point that maybe, again, another thing people could be practicing is to go at times when maybe it's less crowded, so earlier in the day or later in the day, to avoid that midday time when maybe the majority of people might be trying to reach it. So if we can all spread things out a little bit in terms of our timing to the beach, that would also help relieve congestion.
You know, lots of people, doctor, you know, I see wear masks to the beach, but not once they've landed there and are keeping their distance from others, and definitely not in the water. I don't think I've ever seen someone wear a mask in the water. It probably has happened. I just haven't seen it. But is that okay? So it's once you get there and you're keeping your distance, masks become optional in a weird way.
Well, I think, again, when you're out of doors, when you're around people or walking by people, things like this, the mask is really important. If you are fortunate enough to be in an isolated spot on the beach, no one's near you, yes, you could have your mask off. And yes, when you're in the water itself, as long, again, you're not getting close to people, you're surfing or body surfing or just enjoying the water and waiting, all that is okay without having a mask, as long as you have that more distance between you and others.
And just to be clear, safe to swim in the ocean and swimming pools?
Yes, that's a good point. Sometimes people ask that. Yes, it is. COVID-19 is not a waterborne disease. And so that's not the issue. It's being, again, close to people where they might be yelling or screaming. And, you know, you have these droplets that you're inhaling. So that's the reason why we're wanting that physical distancing. But it's not the water itself.
Talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley, professor at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Does the amount of wind make a difference one way or another in terms of the need to wear a mask? Because the beach, is a really breezy place.
Well, again, the if you're going to be within the 6 feet of each other, the mask is really important. Wind is something that helps dilute, if you will, the virus. So just like, proper ventilation in a room, too, helps. So So out of doors is certainly a safer environment than indoors.
But if you're standing right in front of someone and the wind is at both your backs, should you move away or?
No, I think, again, keep that six-foot distance and you'll be safe.
Okay, so what about a barbecue? Because, it's Labor Day weekend and it's the traditional end of summer, as I mentioned, and people want to get together and maybe have something off the grill. So what about barbecues this weekend? How risky are those?
Yeah, so again, fine to have a barbecue with your own family, but this idea of having lots of people coming in to your house, friends or extended family, it really is not the time during the COVID pandemic with these levels of community transmission that are going on. So it's really to be still discouraged.
Doctor, let me ask you this, because we've been having this conversation, you and me, all summer long, it just seems like. And it's a lot of the same stuff, but are you surprised that we still have to kind of reiterate the same things over and over again, restate them?
Well, I think we're seeing that, unfortunately, there are still folks that haven't, maybe they've got the message, but are planning not to read the message and implement the message. I think, again, that's why in the county, people are looking at businesses, making sure that, in fact, they are adhering to these and citing if they are not. And I think that, again, there have been some crackdowns on large parties where people have been congregating. So, I think that hopefully people get the message, look, we just can't be business as usual. And we really want to ride this downslope faster so that we actually can get back to opening, having schools open, et cetera.
I think there are two types of people in the world, Doctor. One where you just tell them once and they're like, okay, got it. And then the other, tell me again. What was that?
Yeah. Yeah. That's... And I think also, in one sense, the 1% infection to mortality ratio that we have with COVID-19, had it been 10 times less, and that would mean less than seasonal influenza, people wouldn't have been worried. Had it been 10 times more, like SARS with 10% of people dying, everybody been following every guidance they could find. So at the 1%, you have some people saying, I don't want to curtail my lifestyle and my job and my functions are really hurting. And others saying, of course, rightly so, that look, every death is something we need to be concerned about. So you have that controversy that's been created in a sense because of the very nature of the 1% infection and mortality rate that has happened.
Now, Doctor, to something now that has got people in some ways excited in some ways, but also questioning in other ways. And we're hearing that the CDC has told public health departments in all 50 states to prepare for a coronavirus vaccine that could be ready as soon as the 1st of November, so right before Election Day. So what do we know about this vaccine, and are there any concerns?
So I think a couple of things. One is that there certainly is going to be a vaccine sometime in the hopefully nearer future than further future. And so I think it is appropriate that CDC, working with state and local governments, start to prepare for how that distribution will occur. So it's always better to be prepared ahead of time than behind the time. So I think the preparation is very important. In terms of the actual timing, it's going to be hard to tell. I think that most of us feel that because these vaccines are now undergoing, some of the vaccines undergoing phase 3 trials, and that takes like 30,000 volunteers, half of them getting basically, placebo, and others getting a vaccine. But then what has to happen is that the people have to get exposed to the disease.
Yeah.
So that you could see who gets protected or not. Then that lets you know the efficacy of the vaccine. And that's what's going to have to be decided before you can actually go to an approval process. However, having said that, as this trial progresses, there are people that are in a data and monitoring group, outside experts, that look at this so that basically they could say, hey, look, this vaccine is harming people, so we got to stop the trial. Or conversely, and hopefully, they can say, hey, this vaccine is really saving lives, really making a difference, and therefore, we can start to consider approval even before going through the whole 30,000 people.
Doctor, considering how many labs all around the world, how many brains of people are focusing on this and nothing else, would it be a shock if a vaccine were to be available and ready to go for the general population sooner rather than later?
I think given the fact there, as you point out rightly, this has been a tremendous moonshot type of effort for vaccine development around the world, not just here in the United States. And so I think that with everyone's best and brightest minds on this, I think we will see something sooner than later. Certainly, I think by the end of this year. However, it may still not be at the manufacturing capabilities to be able to, vaccinate all 300 million people here in the United States. So there's going to be a need at the beginning to give it to high priority groups like people in nursing homes, people with pre-existing conditions, the elderly, healthcare workers that are on the front line, essential workers at grocery stores, things like this. We need to make sure that we're protecting those people who are most at risk of exposures.
And once those people are taken care of, what distribution challenges might arise? I mean, how can health departments make sure everyone has access at some point?
Yeah, so what happens is that we did this somewhat in H1N1 influenza vaccine. As you may recall, it was a scarce supply at the beginning. And so basically health departments, again, working with community-based organizations and the private sector, you know, set up distribution points, including, you know, drive-through centers, you know, mass vaccination sites, screening the people to make sure that they have been, you know, are in the eligible group to receive it. And ultimately, once you have sufficient supplies and you've taken care of those who need it most urgently, then it's open to the general public. And then the health department will be working again with others to make sure that availability is in communities that most need it, underserved communities, available free of charge, et cetera.
Now, one more thing, doctor. I was in line at the pharmacy picking up a prescription when the person at the counter ahead of me was, once they finished their transaction, the person was asked, well, would you like a flu shot today, sir? And he said, no, no way. Are you kidding me with all this stuff going on in the air? And he left. So, you know, we are getting close to that time of year when we would start getting flu shots. One, should we get those this year? And two, what are experts saying about this year's flu season?
Yes, thanks, A. I really think it's very important that you brought this up for your listenership, because that is a real important message to get out, that, you know, flu vaccine is important. It is a good vaccine, that we need to be sure that people have access to it and that people do avail of it, because the worst thing you'd want to have is the situation that could happen where you have both influenza and COVID-19. We don't really know how that would look, but you know, it's something probably you wouldn't want to try. And also, just from the point of view of our healthcare system, you know, we already are somewhat stressing it a bit in times with the COVID surges we've had. If you superimpose a flu season on that, it just could again affect our health systems, and that's something that we want to avoid as well.
That's Dr. Robert Kim Farley, professor at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, A.
More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Now with More Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org, I'm E. Martinez. Remember that first day you stepped onto your college campus full of hope and excitement and maybe just a little bit of dread? Well, think about starting off as a freshman in this environment. Students aren't just getting used to campus life and managing life on their own for the first time. There's COVID-19 to worry about. Even though classes are largely online, already there have been reports of college outbreaks all over the country. Well, one professor who's helping freshmen navigate it all is Andrea Armani. She's a professor of chemical engineering and material science at USC and has two classes filled with first-year students this semester. Now, we checked in with her in the spring as she was getting her class up and running on Zoom, and now she's back. Now, Andrea, the last time we spoke with you, you were getting online learning up and running. That class was filled with upperclassmen, but this year, you have young people who are completely new to college. So, Andrea, how is that going?
So it is exciting, as you already pointed out. You know, freshmen are always super excited for their first day of class. And I actually teach on a Monday and a Tuesday. So I actually had the opportunity to interact with freshmen on their first day of their freshman year. And it was very different this year. I teach this class every fall, and usually first day of freshman year is an in-person experience, and it's like teaching a bunch of little happy squirrels. And this year it was a bunch of little happy faces on Zoom. So it was a very different engagement, but still everybody had that same enthusiasm, excitement to be there, and was asking a lot of really good questions about, you know, how to engage with the institution and with the university. But it is very different having your first day of college be a virtual first day as opposed to an in-person first day.
How do you feel it compared to the spring?
It is a much more controlled chaos environment. First off, the faculty are a lot more familiar with the software. And more importantly, it's not software singular, it's softwares, we have a lot more tools at our fingertips. So a lot of the chemistry labs, for example, are actually doing virtual labs. So instead of doing take-home labs like I did spring semester, there are virtual labs that, you know, a lot of the chemistry faculty have spent the summer tooling and getting set up. There's also a lot of simulation softwares in order to try to mimic a lot of the mechanical engineering labs. So those types of systems have been brought online to try to bring the university to students at home. It's become a lot more of an ecosystem with more interaction between the faculty and the students, as well as between students and students, because that networking component is so important in college.
So what would you say is the biggest challenge you're facing this time around, and how are you navigating around it?
The biggest challenge is that I'm teaching students who've never been to college. So they're trying to both do that huge, you know, transition from being a high school student to a college student. And I'm trying to kind of teach them how to interact, you know, now and operate on a college level without the students, in many cases, actually having left home. So they're trying to make this, you know, emotional adjustment, intellectual adjustment, but they're still kind of, in many cases, in that cocoon of their home. So they're having, you know, kind of an emotional tug of war on, you know, how do they actually make this mental shift, which, you know, we're all in this together, right? Like, we're all trying to get through the pandemic and make it to the other side. So it's a give and take on everybody's side.
Yeah, I can't imagine being a college freshman right now in this time in our history. It just sounds like an extra step that they shouldn't have to deal with, but they are.
I couldn't agree more.
So one more thing about all this, because, and we've talked about this a little bit already, Andrea, is that, you know, part of college is the social aspect. It's just, you just find out who you become when you meet so many different people from around the world. And none of that can be done as effectively as in person. But we know that that generally probably isn't going to happen as much or at all on many college campuses. So how much of an impact do you think this will have on your students in their ability to, number one, enjoy this year and really get the most out of college life?
So I think it will probably impact this semester, although a lot of these student clubs are doing a really good job of having virtual networking events. I know, at least in my class, I had every single student prepare like a one-page PowerPoint slide that, you know, was kind of reminiscent of what you might do in kindergarten, where you write your name, your major, and then like five pictures of things that you love, to help the students connect with each other over things they like, things they don't like. And a lot of the different student clubs and student organizations are doing similar things to try to help the undergrads network and meet other students with like interests. But obviously, you know, it's very different trying to do that virtually than doing it, you know, in person at like a, you know, 300-person party. On the other hand, at least in an engineering school, a lot of those 300-person parties, students might make kind of superficial connections, but they might not exchange information. They might, you know, meet someone, say like, oh, hey, you know, we both like Super Mario Brothers, and then that would kind of be it. And I'm using that as an example because, like, probably you and I know what that is and no one else does.
I was just about to say.
Yeah. Yeah, so it'll be great. So everybody who's our age will laugh. So it's good.
Yeah, I think Animal Crossing clubs, Fortnite clubs, I think those are the clubs that the kids, those crazy kids do these days. I think Super Mario clubs, as you said, are for us way back in the day.
Exactly.
One more thing, Andrew, one more thing. I know that we're all in this reality that we're in, and you said it, we're all stuck in this together right now. So we got to deal with this as best we can. But how important is it that students get back in the classroom at some point?
So I think it's important that students get back in the classroom, particularly engineering and science students, because a lot of the things you learn by failing. And if you're at home all the time, it's going to be really hard for faculty members to create those experiences where you can fail in a protected environment with a safety net, because the faculty member isn't there for you to have that safety net. You won't learn the difference between different types of glassware and how to tell if something is tempered or not. So there's certain like soft skills and almost like an intuition that you get when you actually do something in person, and you don't necessarily need, you know, to spend like all 4 years to do that, but you need, you know, several years of in-person hands-on experience in order to gain that skill set. And at the same time, like when you're teaching online, students can kind of hide behind their screen, right? Like they don't necessarily feel like they have to engage. And when you're in person in a class, you feel like you need to engage with both the students around you and with the faculty member. And that real-time active engagement is very important because it teaches you how to think on your feet and how to speak on your feet, which is a fundamental life skill. Like I can train electrical engineers who go out into the world and maybe they continue being an electrical engineer, but maybe they go to Congress, or maybe they become technical sales, or maybe they become medical doctors. I've had students that have done all of those except for Congress, although one of them might be on their way, and I'm really hopeful. crossing my fingers. So that ability is, you know, independent of the discipline. So that's why it's so important to get students back in the classroom so that they feel and they build the confidence of speaking in front of a diverse audience.
Yeah, it's like being on stage, you know, doing a play. When the curtain goes up, you got to figure out a way to perform. And you could rehearse it all you want alone, you know, by yourself. But yeah, when the curtain goes up, it's
go time.
It's go time. That's right. Andrea Armani is a professor of chemical engineering and material science at USC. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, back in the day, you remember the pre-pandemic, pre-COVID-19 life we used to be living. Well, way back then, L.A. was a really plum spot to visit for the world's fancy people. But even in the fancy people group, there are tiers, actors, rock stars, moguls. And then the fanciest of the fanciest, the visits where the whole city stands up and takes notice. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Los Angeles hosts some pretty big names, but we have to admit that some VIP visits hold more significance than others. Like in the spring of 1983, when royalty graced our fair city. Then several years later, on a bright afternoon, a future Nobel Prize, a Peace Prize winner visited too. These historic visits are the topic of today's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Mike Holland is the Los Angeles City Archivist. He's here to tell us all about the historic visits of Queen Elizabeth II and Nelson Mandela. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, A.
All right, let's start first with Her Royal Majesty. From February to March in 1983, she traveled up the coast of California, hitting communities such as San Diego, L.A., and Santa Barbara, before eventually making her way up north to San Francisco. Let's listen to a tape from her stop there.
Prince Philip and I are most grateful for the warm welcome you have given us in Los Angeles. This same northward journey along the coast of California was made some 400 years ago by Sir Francis Drake, who claimed this territory as Nova Albion for the first Queen Elizabeth and for the Queen's successors forever. I am happy, though, to give you an immediate assurance, Mr. Mayor, that I have not come here today to press that claim.
All right, that's Queen Elizabeth II addressing City Council, charming as ever. So set the scene for us, Mike. What was her reception like when she visited? What was that like back then?
Well, keep in mind that in 1983, we had the new generation of British royalty everywhere. I mean, it was several years after the marriage of Diana and Charles. Mm-hmm. And I believe William was probably an infant at this time. So you had that next generation of royalty. Mm-hmm. You know, slowly coming up and with a worldwide audience, because now with satellite television and, of course, the cable channels that were starting to take shape, 24/7 news cycles were starting to basically follow anybody around who had that kind of charisma, that kind of cachet, that kind of tradition, I guess, is like, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, in 1983, I remember I was a kid back then. The Olympics were going to happen the next year, so there was a definite excitement of just kind of an internationalness to the city at that time. So, what was the purpose of her being here in the first place?
The purpose was basically just a United States tour, and I believe she also went to several spots in the Midwest and the East Coast as well. But you know, you're talking about being a kid at the time. You know what else happened that same week? The last episode of MASH.
Oh.
Premiered that same evening, as a matter of fact.
Whoa. Huh.
Earlier in the day, Bradley had a press conference with a couple of the cast members and a few other people, and then he went from that event to this one with Queen Elizabeth and Philip.
Wow, and MASH might still be what the highest rated finale of all time. I still think it might be at the top, near the top.
It probably is, unless you want to figure what Game of Thrones or some of the other shows have done, but with the different types of broadcast platforms, then MASH may still very well be the top of the heap for, you know, for that.
I wonder if the Queen can just say, I just want to go to L.A. for the weekend. maybe she could.
Right. Well, it rained.
Oh, what? Did it really?
It was raining terribly that day. And so, you know, you can make all sorts of jokes that it was kind of like being back home, I suppose.
Well, we didn't show off our best side then if it was raining.
Not there, no. No, I don't know if it had rained when they were in Palm Springs or San Diego or how, if things had gotten better by the time they got to Yosemite.
All right, so let's jump now to 1990. Another fascinating person came to visit our city, Mr. Nelson Mandela. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Mayor Tom Bradley. We are very happy to be in Los Angeles because Los Angeles is a staunch supporter of the anti-apartheid movement.
All right, so this took place shortly after he'd been released from prison after serving for 27 years. So set the scene for us. What was his reception like?
Mandela had been a symbol of resistance against South African apartheid for nearly 30 years by this point in time. Every African American politician or civic leader or religious leader, they looked to him. They were inspired by him. And according to him, to his own words and Desmond Tutu, what LA did, they saw and they recognized. So one of the first stops that Mandela made, I think he came to 6 U.S. cities. And so by the time he got to Los Angeles at the end of June 1990, they had this tremendous presentation to him and of him on the south steps of City Hall, basically facing south on Spring Street. So where the LAPD building is on the next block, there's that grassy area in between the south steps of City Hall and the LAPD building, and it was just a sea of people.
Wow.
And thankfully, there was a local cable channel that covered it.
Okay, wow.
And so we got the presentation from the city council to Mr. Mandela. Several local politicians like Maxine Waters, Gregory Peck was the host of ceremonies. And then you had Tom Bradley give this great short, relatively short speech. And then it was Mandela's turn. And you know, Mandela just turned everybody on their ear. I mean, it was definitely history in the making.
And he was, just a few years shy of getting the Nobel Peace Prize, right? Not quite yet.
In 1990, he was not yet the Peace Prize winner, which I think he was in 1993. Hmm. And then, of course, the following year, 1994, he was the democratically elected president of South Africa.
Wow. Now, okay,
what a turnaround.
Incredible. Incredible turnaround. Now, okay, so the Queen and Nelson Mandela, two visits very pivotal to LA's history. We're lucky to have them in the archives, right? I mean, because I'm wondering how the city was able to save all this footage.
In the case of Queen Elizabeth, that footage had been recorded by LAPD. We have a tremendous film and video collection from LAPD. The primary purpose of this collection was to create training material for use at the police academy. And so to that end, they were constantly shooting film and then later on video of everything going on in the city that might become a teaching tool at the academy to the new recruits and the cadets. And so as time went on and things changed, in other words, as new tools came along, they updated that material. Now, all of that old material had to go somewhere. And thankfully, we got our hands on a good chunk of it. And so in looking around at the inventories of this collection, I discovered Queen Elizabeth at City Hall. What's this all about?
Wow, oh, my gosh. Thank goodness they didn't just throw it away.
I'm very, very grateful they didn't throw it away. And at the same time, I know there's so much more material that we are in the process of trying to preserve and make available as fast as we can, because video is one of those things that, depending on the format, 5-10 years from now, you won't be able to access it. And so putting it all in perspective, we have today, and if you've got material that you think might be worthwhile, for God's sakes, copy it.
I was going to ask.
And copy it again.
I was going to ask you, Mike, why this is important. You just said it right there, right there. That's Mike Holland, Los Angeles City Archivist, talking about the time Queen Elizabeth II and Nelson Mandela visited Los Angeles. Mike, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, you missed a good show. I mean, way better than yesterday's show, but yesterday's show was pretty good too. But, you know, if you want to compare the two, just head to wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2:00.